Well, we had to turn the tape over. Let's see, where were we? We were discussing about the fires on Mesa Verde.
Oh, the fires on Mesa Verde. That was back in 1972. The Moccasin Mesa fire. The big concern there was it was going to jump across the canyon, because Moccasin Mesa was right across the canyon from Balcony House. And that's all part of Chapin Mesa. And we thought that the fire was going to come across. And because the Park Service had protected the area so carefully over the years with their fire management policies of not letting anything burn, you had a tremendous growth of high brush, pinyon and juniper forest, and just burn that booger down. And about, I think the fire started up at the northern escarpment and burned all the way down to the end of Moccasin Mesa in approximately 12 hours. And it burned hot. And we thought it was going to come across the canyon. So they had a big fire management team come in. And they set up at the New Vista Center there at the head of Chapin Mesa, Farview. And they brought in troops from all over the country, big fire teams. And so that was my first real involvement in big-time production of fires and emergencies and sort of the incident command system, those kind of things. But anyhow, I didn't jump across Chapin Mesa, but I suppose what I remember about that fire and about that whole incident was how Mother Nature takes care of itself. I would give tours in Balcony House, and the spring rains, or the summer rains during the monsoon in July would come, and they would start those black rivers of soot and ashes and just pour them over the edges of Moccasin Mesa, where we could see these big black waterfalls. And for some reason, that stuck in my memory. It was just one of those things. A lot of people didn't appreciate that as much as I did, but another thing that always comes back to me from Mesa Verde and Balcony House and Cliff Palace was just the fact that I could go there after hours and just be inside Cliff Palace all alone, kind of take myself back, and it was just a very nice experience. And you could hear the rock wrens singing, and it was just a good deal. But Mesa Verde was just kind of a learning experience for me. When I went to Petrified Forest, I actually became the best petrified wood thief catcher in the United States. Call them wood boogers, actually, people who steal petrified wood. I found people with petrified wood is kind of sharp, you know, it's flint. Sharp in their pants, down where it counts. And I've had them in their rice, I found it in rice bowls. I found petrified forest, or excuse me, petrified wood in just about every place you can imagine on the human body and in cars. And so I got to where I could just bluff it out of. What you'd do is you'd see somebody who you thought might have stolen some petrified wood, and they all had a certain era of guilt about them. You know, you could always tell. And they always looked a little guilty, especially when you showed up in your uniform. And basically what I would do is when I kind of felt that or sensed that they might be ripping off some of our precious petrified wood, of which actually there's plenty, but not in the park, I would say, "Hi there, you have petrified wood. I'd like to have it back," and just shove my hand out. And lo and behold, about 90% of them would say, "Oh, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to. I just wanted this little piece," and they would hand it back to me. Then if they had a little piece, they always had a bigger piece. And if they had a medium-sized piece, they always had a bigger piece. So there's usually, you could get about 25 pounds of petrified wood back. What we did with that petrified wood was interesting. We'd go down and weigh it, and it depends on how much it weighs, how much we find them. But we would then just throw it out in the ditch, pretty much. Wouldn't take it back to Crystal Forest or Long Logs, where they actually got it in the first place. It was just a policy, I guess, to go dump. You gathered it up, you kept it in case they wanted to go to court, in a sack. Then you split all the sacks open, took it out, and dumped it in one of the washers. But they may have changed that by now, and I didn't really agree with that particular practice. But one thing about a petrified forest had lots of petrified wood, and the thing about petrified forest, of course, the wood was exposed, laying out on the surface where people could get to it and see it, and that was and still is a very nice thing about that place. All around the edges of petrified forest, where the Chinle Formation hadn't eroded down yet, They had mines going on, mining petrified wood, because the Dobells, which had their petrified wood industry down at the south end of the park, I think they've sold out by now. That was back in 1973, 74, 75. It was their goal to put a petrified wood bookends in every home in America. They damn near did it. Even I bought some. It was very nice wood, but they mined that. But the significant thing about Petrified Forest is I learned quite a bit about the Park Service, the politics of it, how it got going. I had was involved in an evaluation team that came out from Grand Canyon, and I actually went up to Grand Canyon, spent a month on a temporary duty doing patrol ranger stuff, arresting drunks and so on. So it kind of gave me a taste of what it was kind of fun doing that stuff. You know, like ambulance runs, heart attack or two, that kind of stuff. So I kind of liked that macho dude ranger groupie stuff. So I was the horse patrol ranger at Petrified Forest the last year and a half I was there, and I developed and set up the horse patrol program, although I didn't really agree with it. I think that rangers sitting on a horse looks very good. However, what they did is spent most of their time, one, getting to the site, two, getting back from the site, and three, hiding in the horse trailer from the sun. So a horse patrol just doesn't work too well in a lot of places. It worked well in Yosemite, and that's how I got to Yosemite. Because I went out to Yosemite on a training, 6 weeks training, horse patrol training, and I caught the eye of the chief ranger and the animal packer foreman, Walt Castle. Chief ranger at the time was a guy named Bill Wendt, and they kind of liked me, and so when an opening came up, boom, they slid me into it. I was on the old ranger intake program, I think from Western Region. So I got in on it and went to the Federal Law Enforcement Training Academy back in Georgia. And when I came back from that, I went to that 6 weeks training. And then when I came back from that, boom, they hired me. So I moved off to Yosemite, which was a big adventure for us. My wife and I loaded all our stuff up into a U-Haul truck. We had two boys at the time. Put the old Chevy on the back end of that U-Haul, and we had a pickup too, and made it to Yosemite in non-record time because the Ford kept breaking down. It was a heck of a mess. Got to Yosemite, very big park. People there are very into themselves because they are in the Crown Jewel Park, and they want everybody to know that they are more experienced than anyone else in the Park Service. They have more going for them. They have a better place to live. They just think they're the wonderful place. I loved Yosemite. I loved all the time I lived there, but I frankly never quite left the Southwest. It was a place where I was raised, and I just preferred the country to the Yosemite gray granites and greens and big trees and rain. It was just no reds, I guess, was the biggest problem I had with it. But the Yosemite experience was a wonderful experience, and I got there. They slid me into position of the assistant fire management officer, and I worked for a guy named Don Cross, who, in my opinion, was the biggest egotistical a-hole there was in the world. I just didn't care for the guy, but managed to get along with him enough to work for him for 2 years. Learned a lot about firefighting. Learned a lot about the incident command system. We would have sometimes 20 fires going at the same time, and I was able to manage those with the crews that we had. And at the time, we had the old Bell helicopter, which is a little bubble, looked like a little big-eyed fly running around. You could only haul 3 people in a backpack in it, I think, at the time. But we managed to do a lot of what we call lightning busts. But you'd have 20, 25 fires burn at the same time, some of them big, some little. You'd have a big incident team on one side doing a 500-acre fire, and then little fires later. So it was the first couple of years in Yosemite was quite an eye-opener for me. What I wanted to do most of all, though, was to be the horse patrol supervisor. And at the time, that particular position was taken up by a guy named Paul Henry, who was a very very good ranger. And I think the time that I spent there before I actually became the horse patrol supervisor was good for me because I was in the fire management offices, and if you're in a fire management office, you learn a lot about all the park, not just Yosemite Valley. And then I became a road patrol ranger for a year and just did regular cop stuff in Yosemite Valley, which gave me a real insight on what road patrol rangers have to put up with. And then I became the horse patrol supervisor after Paul Henry left and went off to FLETC, I think, or to the Federal Law Enforcement Training Center. He was the shooting instructor out there. And I became the horse patrol supervisor, and that was probably the best job I've ever had, next to the one I had after that. Can't think of any jobs I didn't have I didn't really like. Being a horse patrol supervisor was kind of fun because one of the aspects of it, you've got to meet a lot of important people. Because whenever they came to Yosemite, and there was several of them that did, and they wanted to ride a horse around and look at all the pretty scenery. So naturally, the horse patrol had to deal with them. James Watt was one of them, Connie Chung, David Rockefeller, and a few others I can't really recall right off the top of my head.
Queen.
The Queen of England. But James Watt was a kind of a funny situation. He came to town one day, and he was under fire from a lot of environmental areas because he was rather white, right-wing, use and abuse type of guy. But Connie Chung wanted to interview him. I'm pretty sure it was Connie Chung. She was working for a TV station or a news organization out of Los Angeles, and she was to meet him in Yosemite Valley, and they were going to talk. Now, the idea was that they were going to ride along side by side on a horse, each one of them on a horse, and discuss the problems and politics of being the Secretary of Interior. Well, it turned out Connie Chung, scared to death of a horse, had never been on one in her life, apparently. So we had six horse patrol rangers and myself over there, and so you know we were going to have to lead her around by her reins, or the horse anyway, because Connie had no clue. And so it just wasn't going to work. So what they did is they went on out and sat on a rock, and Connie was able to do one of those interviews, which I never did see it, but I understand it was a good interview, with James Watt. So then after that was all over, we all lined up, because we'd been looking pretty good that day, six horses, and we did a two-man front. We marched ourselves, or rode ourselves in formation back to the corral. We went across Awani Meadow, and at that time I was in the lead horse, and I had his own horse named Alex. And he stepped into a big gopher hole, which is filled with hornets, which had a big nest of hornets in there. And as he stepped through the ground and crushed those hornets and then drug his foot back out, he drug them all out with him, and they were angry. And they proceeded to sting the devil out of all of us. In that particular group, we had one ranger named Pete Armington, who's now the chief ranger of Blue Mesa Dam, what is that, Curry County National Recreation Area. Pete Armington, we told him, now, Pete, if you ever have a problem with a horse and starts bucking, you just yank his head around in your lap and stick a spur in the offside and ride him in a circle, and he'll calm down pretty soon. So we all of us experienced, more experienced riders. We went kayaking off. I didn't get too many bee stings, but boy, I tell you. And we look back, and there's old Pete Armington still riding around and around that bee nest with that horse's face pulled up in his lap. And them bees just stung the hell out of him. It was really funny, actually. We got a big kick out of it. Armington didn't, nor did his horse. His horse was named Peter. That was one of the things about big wheels. They have a lot of problems. Queen of England showed up, and we had a lot of activity there. I think for some reason they thought that if the Queen of England was shot in Yosemite National Park, it would reflect forever upon the National Park. So it was probably quite true. Secret Service was nervous as a cat, and if you've ever dealt with the Secret Service, which I don't know if anybody has, they're a real nervous bunch. They're generally they try to oversimplify the problems in national parks when they have big wheels coming in. They try to make sure that their own people are involved and that nobody else, of course, knows anything about protecting anybody except the Secret Service, which actually they're pretty good at their job, but they can be real obnoxious, is a good word for the Secret Service at times. But they came in full force, and we brought in several SEP teams. A SEP team is a group of rangers which are specifically gathered up to go deal with a particular problem, and in this instance was a visit of the Queen of England, and stand around and guard perimeters. What we did, we had about seven or eight perimeters, it seemed like, because we had that many rangers. And the Queen of England stayed in the Awani Hotel, and we They had a perimeter of guards around that. They had the Secret Service stand in the hotel. And they had a perimeter of rangers. And they had another perimeter of rangers. And then they had the horse patrol wandering around out there. There was a... And as the Duke said, he says, "My God, there must be a man behind every tree out there protecting them." But it was a lot of fun. We made a lot of overtime, primarily. Got to insult a lot of the Secret Service and presidential aides and stuff like that who thought they could get through because they'd flash their little pins at us and all. And they would say, "Well, don't you know who we are? Don't you recognize this pen? We work for the White House." And we always would say, "No." We had a great time with those guys. But the Queen, they had a split party one time. I guess in one of the little adventures we had while she was there, was that she and the Duke drove out to Mirror Lake. And then the Duke decided he wanted to get out and walk back to the awning, which is like about a mile and a half little hike. And the Queen just said, "No, I don't want to do it. I think I'll drive back." So they had a big crisis. The party had split up, and we had to protect two different areas. So naturally, the call went out to the horse patrol. And me and Carol Moses, who was my assistant at the time, we spurred our horses, and we went galloping down this path to go protect the Duke from some imaginary foe, because actually, I don't know how anybody could have heard him. Nobody would have known he was even there. Went sailing around the corner about 30 miles an hour. Little horse is hard charging, and there's the Duke. So actually, we almost ran over the guy, and I could just see the headlines, you know, where Yosemite Rangers on horse patrol kill the Duke. But we kind of sailed off out in the brush, turned around, and rode beside him, act like nothing ever happened. The Duke was kind of pale. I don't know whether he remembers that or not, but it was a close call. We almost ran over the guy. But that was, I suppose, some of the adventures. We had lots and lots of adventures, introduced to lots of dead bodies. Yosemite is a very active national park with a big climbing, rock climbing population. We have floods in the spring, which people put their little inner tubes on and go sailing down the river in them, and sometimes they make it, and quite often they don't. A lot of heart attacks, those kind of things. And medical emergencies became very interested in that for a while. Law enforcement was a big thing there. We busted a lot of people for drugs, beating up their wives, murder, you name it. We got involved in just about everything. Burglars. So the law enforcement EMT type of adventure, I really liked it. It was a lot of fun. But after about 5 years of continuous doing it, you kind of get burned out. Big expeditions, you know, for search and rescues, big incident command systems for like the Queen or floods, and we had huge snowstorms. Yosemite is a land of natural disasters. We had big rock falls which squashed people all up and down the Yosemite Falls Trail. Earthquakes. My wife was a dispatcher at the time. She dispatched some of the major events there. Was the best dispatcher probably in the National Park Service, right, huh? She's shaking her head. But anyhow, those kind of adventures were very good in Yosemite. But there really wasn't a time to relax, and we were still coming back to the Southwest. We'd take a whole month of October off, because October is a really pleasant time to be out in the Southwest, at least the first half of October is. And then we'd drive the 900 miles back to Cortez, and we'd stay with my wife's folks, or we'd stay with friends. The next job I got was at Grand Canyon, and I just kept putting in for jobs. I wanted a promotion, which it finally came through. I became one of the most, one of the better jobs, I think, in the world, next to horse patrol supervisor. And actually, I think it's better. It was Canyon District Ranger. I became Canyon District Ranger in 1984. It was, I was in charge of all ranger services below the rim. And that became, it was just a wonderful job. Grand Canyon is probably the premier national park in the service. Yellowstone's nice, I guess, but you only visit it 3 months a year because you freeze yourself to death. And Yosemite's okay, but it's frankly urbanized and too crowded now. Even the backcountry is wore out. Grand Canyon is still, hopefully it'll remain so, the ultimate backcountry park. They have that small area on the south rim and the north rim that, you know, all of America comes and peers over the rim and then blasts off to wherever else they were going. But if you hang out in Grand Canyon, as I did for 5 years, you'll find that it's probably one of the better parks in the world. Well, I think it was 6 years, actually, almost, before I went to Canyon de Chelly. Grand Canyon was great. Well, Grand Canyon, like I said, is the best national park in the system, I think, because it's still really what a national park ought to be. It's got a tiny bit of urban and a whole lot of backcountry. And you can go out in Grand Canyon and you can actually hike a trail and never see a soul and actually stay there for a year and never see anybody but yourself and maybe a lizard or two, maybe a coyote. There's still those types of places. But it also offers other things, like you can catch a rainbow trout, dang near 3 feet long. You can catch humpback chubs accidentally if you put the right cheese on a treble hook. You can do river trips, backcountry hikes. And as a ranger there, you know, I had all the best of everything. I could helicopter in here and there. Did river trips, didn't cost me anything. It was just the ultimate ranger life. And also, I was very heavily involved in the politics of running that national park. The river management plan came up for review. The backcountry management plan came up for review during my time there. And the battles that we fought, the politics that we played, the enemies we made, which were numerous, over that whole trying to gain control and maintain control of that wonderful resource of the Colorado River. And that battle's still going on. Who actually is going to control that river? Is it going to be the concessioners, the 20 concessioners who are there? Is it going to be strictly for tourists? Are we going to add more and more tourists? Is it going to be Bureau of Reclamation, you know, and their ability to control how much water goes down the river? So that battle's still going on right now, even though I'm out of it. I still maintain a real connection to Grand Canyon. Would like to go back there, actually. As a bigger wheel than I was then, although I was a very active ranger. I might be in the superintendent of Grand Canyon. I don't look for that to happen, but certainly would be a great job. But I spent 5 or 6 years there and had a wonderful time. Did a lot of different things. But then after about the 6th year of answering the same letters to the same concessioners about their wanting to add more people to their tours or maybe bigger boats, you know, and it occurred to me that some of those concessioners simply weren't getting the idea that this national park is a finite resource, that it's going to end, that they couldn't continue to pump people into it and use it, and their only concern about Grand Canyon National Park is how much money can I make off of it. They'd sit in their offices in Flagstaff or Page or wherever. They do their river trips, but they go hiking off of it now and then, but to really take a view of that national park as something that we really need to preserve simply wasn't happening. Might be better now. So we had to stuff a lot of regulations down their throat, especially during the river management plan, and the load of people that could go in. And we regulated how many people could go in and out. Same with the backcountry management plan. We regulated through the backcountry reservations office how many people could go in and out of that park and hike the trails. And we also take into consideration, which I think is a novel approach to things, the fact that if you were out there all by yourself and saw no people, that was one quality experience. You saw 10 people, that was a different level. You saw 20 people, that's a different level. So we took into consideration that some of those areas should have no one except yourself out there. So we would regulate where you could be the only hiker in a certain area, which I think is something that people really need. Also, It occurred to me that while I was at Grand Canyon that the people all over the United States, all the people in the United States, were connected to Grand Canyon, whether they were here or not. They wanted to know, and they wanted to be assured by the government that there was an area or several areas in the United States that was being preserved like the old ways, like the old West. And it made them, I think, it makes people feel more comfortable knowing that the National Park Service, and that's why we're so popular, I believe, is taking good care of certain areas of the country that they hold dear, even though they may not have even been there. So that's one of the key things, I think, that maintains our support, is they know that we're taking good care of an area. We, at least we hope we are. Well, in 1989, the former superintendent of Grand Canyon, Dick Marks, who became a good friend of mine, even though he was kind of wild, made me an offer I was afraid to refuse. He said, why don't you come out? They just had a big incident happen at Canyon de Chelly National Monument, where we had these burglaries taking place in cars for many years. And one of the rangers, the chief ranger at the time, a guy named Miller, I can't think of his first name, Dan Miller or Dave Miller, he took it upon himself to try to solve that car clouting problem. And this one particular family, which had been doing it and can still continuing to do it, actually, breaking into people's cars still. So he trapped a guy out there on the edge of the Antelope House overlook, got in a fight with him, and he shot him and killed him. They both fell off the cliff about 30 feet. Miller survived, thank goodness. And the Navajo, I think he was a Clark, I can't think of his first name now, he died. So there was a big scare in our Southwest Regional Office that the Navajos, who still own Canyon de Chelly, they own the land and the natural resources, both above and below ground, were going to get real ticked off at us for shooting one of their own. Well, actually, this guy was a scumbag from the word go. He'd probably killed or helped kill several people around there and robbed them of their money. He was just like all other societies. There are people in it which people just soon have not have around. So there was absolutely no reaction from the Navajos over this, except maybe a slight applause. However, we had a big SET team come out, and they had 24-hour patrols at Canyon de Chelly. If you've ever been to Canyon de Chelly, it's just hard to imagine that. So because I had a lot of experience in situations like that, I knew a lot about the Southwest. I knew quite a bit, and I was also done a good job for Dick Marks in the river management plan and running Canyon District. He asked me to come out to Canyon de Chelly and manage the area for the current superintendent, which is a guy named Herb Yazzie, and be the what they call the, at that time, was a chief of operations. Chief of operations is a position that ran everything in the park except the superintendent. Supervised maintenance and rangers and everything. It wasn't a big crew, it was about population, about 25 employees. Our budget was like $800,000, which compared to my former budget at Grand Canyon, I think I was over $1 million by then, and that just the Canyon District alone. But anyhow, I moved. It was a great stressful move because it was taking a big chance. You know, when you talk to people about going to Canyon de Chelly, they generally turn to ashen. And it was not something that people like to do out there. Chimney, Arizona was not a place where a person wanted to move too often. It was a very conservative area as far as the Navajo people are concerned. Most of them are very conservative, kind of like Cortez types, the rednecks, very conservative, very traditional. But I moved into the house in Canyon de Chelly, became established, and Carol, my wife, and my family, I moved up to Cortez. Now it's only 150 miles, but and being from the Southwest and being rangers and all that, driving a car for long distances just simply doesn't, it's not a big deal. Or some people, if they drive over 15 miles, think it's a big deal. But driving 200 miles, 400 miles, 300, 600 miles a day is something that we do fairly routinely. And so moving Carol to Cortez, her hometown, by the way, she was born there and never really left, and moving her on to her father's place, which we bought from him, from the estate after he passed away, was something that she always wanted. So it was the best of both worlds. I wanted to continue being a ranger, and I wanted to get into management, which I was, and she wanted to go back to Cortez and reestablish her links with the community. So that's what happened. Canyon de Chelly was absolutely unique. I know you're not supposed to use the word unique unless it's really true, and this is really true. Canyon de Chelly is a unique area, a unique park experience. My supervisor was a Navajo, Herb Yazzie. Very, very wonderful man, very quiet. Actually, you could say he was shy and simply didn't like to manage. Although he was a superintendent, he didn't really want to do that. He liked getting the money for it. So what happened is I flew to Santa Fe to meet the current Southwest Regional Director, John Cook, who had spent some time at Canyon de Chelly in his early days. He was the assistant superintendent of Canyon de Chelly. He was the first superintendent of Hubble's National Monument, National Historic Park. And so had extensive experience, and his heart was with Canyon de Chelly. He wanted to see something good happen to it, and he hoped to be able to resolve some problems that they'd been having with Navajo tribal government. So he took the recommendations of Dick Marks. They later had a big falling out, and Dick Marks retired suddenly, and so there was a shadow cast across me from that particular, because I was up in the big-time politics now. It's just a lot of politics. So anyhow, I managed to manage Canyon de Chelly without getting shot, although my first year there, there was a lot of calls for my removal, and I tried to learn the words for get a rope in Navajo, because I wanted to be able to recognize when they told each other that, so I had to run out the back door and some of the public meetings I wanted to do. But the Navajos are good people. They want what's best for Canyon de Chelly, and at the same time, they want to make as good a living as the rest of us. And sometimes the two can't mix. So the object was to tie a lot of the Navajos that were working around Canyon de Chelly and using it for sort of part-time money as guides or whatever, tie them a little more economically to the canyon. So I made several changes in the way we approached that community. One was to